I suppose it's pure coincidence that Iran has such vast oil reserves and that the last country we invaded also had huge oil reserves.
This is a country where a national experiment is going on between Islam and democracy. The country has not quite figured out how much of each chemical to put into the beaker.
I think we're on the eve of the most sweeping and potentially destructive overhaul of the FCC's media rules in the history of American broadcasting.
There's no way to achieve safety and security for Americans without getting out of there and allowing the self-determination of the Iraqi people themselves.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, May 30th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration today dropped the federal terrorism alert level one step to yellow, saying intelligence pointing to an imminent attack has decreased. The higher orange alert lasted 10 days. No domestic terrorist strikes were attempted during that period. President Bush says Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan must cut off financial aid to terrorist groups and help ensure the security of Israel to foster the creation of a Palestinian state in a Middle East peace agreement. Trying to isolate longtime Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat, Bush said he has come to realize that it was impossible to achieve peace with Chairman Arafat. He's failed the Palestinian people in the past, says Bush. Bush will hold twin Mideast summits next week, one with Prime Minister Ariel Sharon of Israel and Mahmoud Abbas, the new Palestinian prime minister, and the other with the leaders of Saudi Arabia, Jordan, and Egypt, as well as Abbas. The Bush administration focused on alleged weapons of mass destruction as a primary justification for toppling Saddam Hussein by force because it was politically convenient, a top-level official at the Pentagon has acknowledged. The extraordinary admission comes in an interview with Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Defense Secretary, in the July issue of the magazine Vanity Fair. Mr. Wolfowitz also discloses that there was one justification that was almost unnoticed but huge. That was the prospect of the United States being able to withdraw all of its forces from Saudi Arabia once the threat of Saddam Hussein had been removed. Meanwhile, The Times UK reports that the war has taken its toll on the impoverished Iraqi town of Qurna, where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers meet in the biblical site of the Garden of Eden. Dozens of dead fish float in a river that reeks of sewage, dirty sheep chew at the few tufts of grass that survive in the baking earth, and litter swirls around in the dust, the paper reports. In Baghdad, the environmental and humanitarian situation is approaching crisis proportions, with promised relief from American occupation forces still slow to arrive. Peace Watch's Aaron Glantz has more.
The dehydration ward at Mansour Pediatric Hospital on the banks of the Tigris River in northern Baghdad. Authorities opened the special ward after seeing a 500% increase in the number of children suffering from acute dehydration after the war. The dehydration is caused by Baghdad's contaminated water supply. Dr. Allah is an anesthesiologist working in the new ward.
We were told by the U.S. officials that there's fecal material in the water, and they told their soldiers also not to use the water.
He says more than 100 children under the age of 5 arrive at his hospital every day now with diseases inflicted by fecal matter that seeped into the city's water supply. He estimates 600 children are hospitalized from complications from diarrhea every day in the city of Baghdad.
Septicemia, renal problems, renal shutdown, renal failure goes into neurological shutdown, goes into meningitis, and also goes into severe chest infection.
Every day, Dr. Allah says, one or two babies dies in Al Mansour Hospital. Because of economic sanctions that followed the 1991 Gulf War, Mansour Hospital, like the other hospitals in Baghdad, lacks the lab equipment necessary to diagnose these diseases. So the doctors give their patients a cocktail of antibiotics and hope for the best. The sanctions also are responsible for the dilapidated state of Baghdad's water treatment system. Under the sanctions regime, it was difficult for Iraqi officials to import spare parts for their water treatment plants. With the war and American occupation, no repairs or purchases have been done in at least 3 months. Nick Southern is a water expert for the American nonprofit aid group, CARE.
Sewage tankery and the big suction pumps are not working. The pumping stations are not being repaired. The spare parts are not being availed. The workers do not have the spares and the equipment to actually move and repair these things in a way that would address all the problems that are happening all over the, particularly the urban areas and particularly Baghdad.
As a result, Southern notes, stagnant pools of raw sewage are backing up in the streets.
Sewers are backing up into the streets, and you're seeing black water pooling in the streets. As I came to the office this morning, I came through an area where a pumping station had blocked, and there, you can smell it for several hundred meters in every direction. If one pumping station goes out, then the system degrades way back up through the network. As that happens, and as we move into what is now the hot season in Iraq in the next month or two, we have a recipe for a very considerable public health crisis.
Already there have been almost a dozen cases of cholera reported in the southern city of Basra and a handful of cases in Baghdad. The humanitarian aid agency UNICEF is warning of a cholera epidemic if steps aren't taken immediately. In the meantime, Dr. Allah advises residents of Iraq not to drink the water without boiling it twice and not to bathe without boiling it once. For Pacificus Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Baghdad, Iraq.
Across the border in Iran, ABC News is reporting the Pentagon is advocating a massive covert action program to overthrow Iran's ruling Ayatollahs and stop the country's alleged nuclear weapons ambitions. But Reese Ehrlich, veteran foreign correspondent and producer of the public radio special The Struggle for Iran, is not surprised by the revelations. Speaking with Peace Watch earlier today, he said that these sorts of plans have often occurred in the history of U.S.-Iranian relations, and though the details may change, the ultimate goal remains the same.
I think that this is typical of what the U.S. has been doing for many years in Iran. You find an excuse and then use it as a means to try and attack what is a legitimate government. I have very strong disagreements with the policies of the Iranian government, particularly the hardline mullahs. But they have every right. There's a sovereign government, and the U.S. has absolutely no right to covertly or overtly overthrow the government of Iran. We saw the same arguments in Iraq, and they're proving to have been completely false. There are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. There was no links to al-Qaeda. The U.S. is now floating the same arguments for Iran, so why should the American people or anybody else believe the Bush administration now?
Mm. There's also the phrase of regime change being floated. In fact, senior Bush administration officials met at the White House yesterday to discuss U.S. strategy towards Iran, but it's being reported that they're far from reaching any sort of consensus. And while most people within the administration agreed on the goal of achieving regime change in Iraq, when it comes to Iran, apparently there's a deep divide over whether that should be a goal of U.S. foreign policy. Can you talk a little bit more about recent U.S.-Iranian relations and bring us up to date with the current standoff?
Sure. The U.S. faces a far more difficult problem in Iran than it did in Iraq. First of all, there is a vibrant movement inside Iran of forces for reform, for more democracy. President Khatami, members of the Iranian parliament, have been struggling for many years now against basically a reactionary rule by the conservative mullahs who exercise power through the judiciary, the police, and some other institutions. So you have a battle that has been going on within the constitutional framework of Iran. So the U.S. can't make the claim, as it did in Iraq, that there's a one-man dictatorship. Secondly, the U.S. is very much bogged down in Iraq right now, as we see American soldiers being killed on an almost daily basis. That's not going according to the Bush plan, and they're not in any shape to invade somebody else while they still haven't even settled the war in Iraq, let alone the war in Afghanistan. And thirdly, the Iranian people are not going to be a pushover. The Iraqi military forces, unfortunately, were highly demoralized as a result of many years of corrupt rule. they're Iranians, whether they be reformers or hardliners, are going to put up a very stiff fight if the U.S. tries some kind of military action against Iran, and even the doofuses in the White House have to understand that.
Hmm. And it seems that the Pentagon has proposed this policy of regime change, but the plan is opposed by the State Department and the British government. How do you see this sort of scenario playing out?
Yeah, well, there's, you know, people, they all favor regime change. They have different tactics about how to go about it. And the State Department and Europeans generally realize what a complete disaster it would be for the U.S. to take covert or overt military action against Iran. So I'm not surprised that you see a split between the State Department and the Pentagon on this. You saw some similar tactical differences over Iraq, although ultimately they all agreed because they share the fundamental goal of empire, which is to have a regime change in countries that the U.S. doesn't like, and then you find some convenient excuses to justify it.
Mm-hmm. And so what is the underlying motivation, in your opinion, for going into Iran?
Well, I suppose it's pure coincidence that Iran has such vast oil reserves and that the last country we invaded also had huge oil reserves. I'm sure that's pure coincidence. The U.S. has a lot of strategic interests in controlling and dominating world oil supplies to the extent that it can, and that drives a lot of U.S. policy. Iran is also a strong supporter of certain factions among the Palestinians, very much opposed to Israeli expansion and occupation of Palestine. And the U.S. would like to see, as well as the Israelis would like to see, an end to that. Notice that every time the U.S. invades a country, it establishes temporary military bases, which then tend to become permanent. We saw it in five new countries after the Afghanistan war, five to eight new countries after the Iraq war, including four military bases in Iraq.
And there are about 100 or so around the world.
Yeah, so every time you have a war, you set up temporary bases, and then they become permanent. So you have economic interests, oil, you have military interests setting up new bases, and you have geopolitical interests all expanding the empire.
Are you saying, Reese Ehrlich, that there's no legitimacy whatsoever to the administration's claim with regard to Iran that they could possibly be harboring weapons of mass destruction?
Well, you know, I think, I don't know, and frankly, I don't even think the Bush administration knows. Sticking with facts doesn't seem to be of any great concern to them. If the Bush administration is genuinely worried about nuclear weapons in Iran, there are international procedures to verify that. The Iranians are part of the International Atomic Energy Commission protocols. Inspectors from that body could be sent into Iran to inspect the nuclear power facilities. The Iranians claim they're not developing weapons. Everything they're developing is for peaceful nuclear power. That can be verified. It doesn't take the 101st Airborne parachuting into Tehran to figure that out. Let's follow the normal procedures and allow the international bodies to do their work.
Mm. And in terms of Britain and the British factor in this, the British seem to be very uneasy with this plan. The U.S. failed to seek a second U.N. resolution for its invasion of Iraq. At least it had the support of the United Kingdom, though. So it could claim a so-called coalition of the willing. But if it fails to garner support, do you think the U.S. would go so far as to act even without British cooperation if it ends up launching a military campaign against Iran?
I think the U.S. was incredibly isolated around Iraq. They'd be even more isolated around Iran, which would be one more contributing factor to slowing them down. And now, are there people, are there cowboys in the White House and the Pentagon who would invade anybody at the drop of a hat? Yes, there are. But even those folks are constrained politically, not to mention economically. Let's look at what happened in Iraq. The U.S., the so-called coalition of the willing, in fact, consisted of the U.S. and Britain, and that was it. The rest of the countries contributed virtually no troops or money. Now, what does that mean? It means that the U.S. was hampered militarily because it couldn't invade Iraq from the north, from Turkey. It's hampered now because nobody else will take over the nation building and the policing. So the U.S. troops, they were going to try and stand them down very quickly. In fact, there's some 200,000 plus U.S. and British troops that are going to be there for some time, costing $20 billion a year plus on top of the cost of the war itself. This is a tremendous drain on the U.S. resources, on the economy. Something like 40% of all active duty troops in the United States are now stationed in Iraq. I mean, we're supposed to, theoretically, to be fighting terrorism or protecting our country, and meanwhile, we're permanently stationing a bunch of American troops in one country that doesn't want to be occupied. So the U.S., as mighty as it is, has limitations on its power, and I think the American people are going to start to see that in the months ahead as the economy worsens and as the occupation doesn't go as planned.
Well, that was my next question. What about the domestic factor here? The president enjoyed very favorable support by and large, although hundreds of thousands, millions of Americans opposed this invasion into Iraq. What are the chances it would enjoy that same sort of support around an invasion into Iran?
Well, I think public opinion in the United States is very volatile. We have to remember that at one point, 55% of the people, according to polls, opposed invading Iraq without U.N. sanction. Then that flipped. Right now, the president is enjoying generally favorable opinion polls, although it's dropping, interestingly enough. If the quagmire that is Iraq continues, I think his ratings will continue to drop. Is the administration capable of whipping up popular sentiment against Iran for a possible invasion there? Sure. Look at the role of the mass media, the mainstream media in this country, which goes along with pretty much anything that the White House has to say, no matter how outrageous the lies. But that opinion, it's not so easy to sustain that opinion as the reality becomes clear. I, for one, think that Bush is going to have some serious problems in the November election, particularly if the Democrats put up anybody decent as a candidate, then there may well be a regime change in Washington in November.
Reese Ehrlich is a veteran foreign correspondent and producer of the public radio special The Struggle for Iran, hosted by Walter Cronkite. He also co-authored the book Target Iraq, What the News Media Doesn't Want You to Know. In Iran, conservative religious forces have closed reformist newspapers, afraid that people might learn the truth about government corruption and repression. But having a more open press in the U.S. doesn't necessarily mean Americans get accurate reporting about Iran. In fact, critics say for many years, major U.S. media distorted events in Iran in furtherance of U.S. foreign policy goals. We present now an excerpt of Reese Ehrlich's public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, hosted by Free Speech Radio news anchor Deepa Fernandez.
The 1950s was a trying time for the U.S. media.
Last night I discussed the communists in the State Department. I stated that I had the names of 57 card-carrying members of the Communist Party. When I have the names of 57, you can be right well sure there are a lot more.
Many major newspapers uncritically reported Senator Joseph McCarthy's smears, and many reported foreign policy issues from a simplistic anti-communist perspective. In 1950, Mohammad Mossadegh became prime minister in Iran. He was a nationalist who favored greater democracy and initially enjoyed U.S. support. But in 1953, he nationalized Western oil holdings in order to give Iranians a greater share of the country's oil wealth. That outraged the oil companies and the U.S. government. Professor Mansour Farhang, who now lives in New York, is a former Iranian ambassador to the UN and has written a book analyzing U.S. media coverage of Iran.
The press depicted it as very radical, that Iranians were not capable of doing this. It was going to disturb the international oil market. It was something unusual, which it was.
Prime Minister Mossadegh allowed political parties and newspapers of all political stripes to function openly. But Professor Farhang says both the U.S. government and media vilified the Prime Minister because he wouldn't side with the U.S. against the USSR.
They didn't believe in neutrality. They didn't believe in authentic democratic development within a country, but that was not an ally of the West or the East. These articles portray Mossadegh as either a communist, which was absolutely outrageous, or someone who really didn't have a coherent view of what he wanted.
U.S. government documents now confirm that in 1953, the CIA masterminded a coup against Prime Minister Mossadegh. The U.S. installed the pro-Western Shah Reza Pahlavi.
In the quick shift of power, Mossadegh was finally apprehended and awaits trial for treason. The Shah, who had fled to Rome, comes home, backed by General Zahedi, military strongman, who engineered his return to power. Iranian oil may again flow westward.
From 1953, after the coup, to 1979, the image of Iran in the U.S. media is a country going through the process of modernization.
Professor Mansour Farhang.
He is pursuing modernization and reform from the top. A modernizing monarch who was, as Henry Kissinger said, an unconditional ally.
The Shah's well-rounded personality is felt throughout Iran. Like his father, the present Shah has always had one thing uppermost in mind, to improve the lot of his people.
Norman Solomon, a nationally syndicated media columnist, says the press rarely reported the repression, torture, and lack of human rights in Iran. He says the major media took their cue from U.S. government policy, which saw those problems as secondary to maintaining a stable, pro-Western regime.
This is chronic reliance on official sources, which is not what journalism should be. Authentic journalism should be independent, assertive, inquiry that is not tied to specific official sources. Instead, we had something akin to stenography of the top officials in Washington.
Elaine Schiolino disagrees. She's a senior correspondent with the New York Times, who's covered Iran extensively for over 20 years. She says, given difficult circumstances, many U.S. reporters covered the story well.
Were there journalists who, you know, had special relationships with the Shah and with the U.S. government at the time? Absolutely. Did American diplomats tend to curry favor with the Shah and not report on what was going on in the mosques? Absolutely. But I would argue that, yes, there was a lot of bad journalism before the revolution, but there was also a lot of good journalism.
Professor Farhang says after the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and particularly after the seizure of the U.S. embassy later that year, U.S. media adopted a new set of biases.
Religion and fanaticism come to replace the modernizing frame.
Religion in Iran has always been a passionate, pervasive force. And so, Iran has turned its back on the outside world.
There was no economics, there was no politics, there was no culture, the society was not pluralistic, the social classes having very diverse tendencies, not at all. The dominant tendency and the dominant frame became religion and virtually nothing else.
In 1997, Iranians elected reformist President Mohammad Khatami. Then in 2000, they elected a reformist majority to parliament, but conservatives maintain control in other institutions. The political situation remains complicated, and U.S. policymakers haven't developed a unified policy towards Iran. In this context, says Professor Farhang, the U.S. media are less likely to take their cues from U.S. policymakers.
Overall, I would say the current press coverage is far better than what it was in the past, and the principal reason is that there is a distrust of the official sources, is skepticism of what officials say to the journalists.
This is a country where a national experiment is going on between Islam and democracy. The country has not quite figured out how much of each chemical to put into the beaker to prevent a massive explosion.
New York Times correspondent Elaine Schiolino.
As a journalist, this is very exciting. It's very dangerous. It's very adventurous because every day one sees this experiment playing out in the streets, in the courts, in the parliament, in the presidential palace, in the villages, in the universities.
When U.S. policymakers focused a great deal of attention on Iran through the 1980s, some major media delivered their most biased coverage. Today, with the end of the Cold War and the situation in Iran far more complicated, at least some major media are providing far better information. For the Iran Project, I'm Deepa Fernandes in New York.
As the occupation of Iraq enters its second month and the Pentagon sets its sights on Iran and other so-called rogue nations, we're going to take a step back in time on Peace Watch today to listen to the words of U.S. Marine Officer Smedley Butler. Butler served in the Marine Corps in the early 1900s, earning 2 Congressional Medals of Honor. He's become something of a Marine Corps legend, not only for his personal courage, but for the energy he put into avoiding bloodshed when it was possible to achieve his aims in other ways. He offers these thoughts on who wages wars and who's responsible for stopping them.
If wars are to be avoided by our country, it can be done only by determined and simple political action on the part of the great majority of our people, the trusting majority, which majority does not get up the wars, but which does fight them and which does pay all the bills in blood and money. So it is this great majority to which these remarks are addressed in an effort to awaken their interest. This great majority has neither the time nor the inclination to study the so-called economic causes of war. This majority is interested only in keeping out of wars of all kinds. This majority is not vitally interested in the means by which we are kept out of war, for you must remember, wars do not occur, they are made by men. All efforts which keep us out will be approved, and there will never be a congressional investigation into the steps taken or the methods adopted which save us from a war. There would be nothing to investigate. Men who took part in a peace prayer program would be only too willing to publish to the world all their moves. Men who bring on wars never rush into print with proud statements of how they did the job. Men apologize for their part in bringing on wars, and they're always on the defensive. But men who skillfully save their nations from the disasters of war never hide their lights under a bushel, and rightfully so. Dishonest, subcellar, crooked, selfish national action inevitably leads to war, but it never leads to peace. Action leading to peace is never conducted in the dark. It is above board, where all can see and be grateful. Heads of nations are censored for bringing on wars. Did you ever hear of a ruler roundly condemned for preserving peace? Lying propaganda is almost certainly necessary to arouse a nation to the pitch where men kill and women give their men and boys to be killed. No lying is necessary to keep a nation at peace. All that is necessary is the wide circulation of the truth, the whole truth and nothing but the truth. As wide circulation of the truth as of the lying propaganda will do more than anything to end wars. Every war which Americans have fought or may fight in the future outside their own continental boundaries has been or will be a racket, a mean, cruel, yes, filthy racket. By racket, I mean something that appears to be one thing to the crowd, but in reality, to a favored few insiders, is something entirely different. All men responsible for rackets have been and will be on the defensive. During our participation in the World War, our soldiers, even those from California, thought they were fighting to defend their home, to make the world safe for democracy. We're fighting a war to end wars. Rot. Pure, unadulterated, sickening rot. The underlying secret causes which led those in authority to send our soldiers thousands of miles overseas in the past were not the reasons given those soldiers for their going. It is too much to expect that this nation will be kept at peace by those whose financial condition would benefit by our participation in a war. The mass of the people who have nothing to gain but everything to lose must keep us out. The steps taken to keep us out must be fully understood and vigorously supported by this mass. Appealing peace slogans must be coined, and there could be nothing more potent than this one, namely, attend to our own business.
U.S. Marine Officer Schmedley Butler died in 1940. Special thanks to Cat Radio Cafe at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York for production assistance with that piece. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.